Chapter 31. It was plain that I had worked myself out, pumped myself dry. So I knocked off and went to playing billiards for a change. I haven't had an idea or a fancy for 2 days. Now an excellent time to write to friends who have plenty of ideas and fancies of their own, and so will prefer the offerings of the heart before those of the head. Day after tomorrow I go to a neighboring city to see a five-act drama of mine brought out, and suggest amendments in it, and would about as soon spend a night in the Spanish Inquisition as sit there and be tortured with all the adverse criticisms I can contrive to imagine the audience is indulging in. But whether the play be successful or not, I hope I shall never feel obliged to see it performed a second time. My interest in my work dies a sudden and violent death when the work is done. I have invented and patented a pretty good sort of scrapbook, I think, but I have backed down from letting it be known as mine just at present, for I can't stand being under discussion on a play and a scrapbook at the same time. I shall be away 2 days, and then return to take our tribe to New York, where we shall remain 5 days buying furniture for the new house, and then go to Hartford and settle solidly down for the winter. After all that fallow time, I ought to be able to go to work again on the book. We shall reach Hartford about the middle of September, I judge. We have spent the past 4 months up here on top of a breezy hill, 600 feet high, some few miles from Elmira, NY, and overlooking that town.
Elmira is my wife's birthplace and that of Susie and the new baby.
This little summer house on the hilltop named
Quarry Farm, because there's a quarry on it,
belongs to my wife's sister, Mrs. Crane. A photographer came up the other day and wanted to make some views, and I shall send you the result per this mail. My study is a snug little octagonal den, with a coal grate, 6 big windows, 1 little one, and a wide doorway,
the latter opening upon the distant town.
On hot days I spread the study wide open, anchor my papers down with brickbats, and right in the midst of the hurricanes, clothed in the same thin linen we make shirts of. The study is nearly on the peak of the hill. It is right in front of the little perpendicular wall of rock left, where they used to quarry stones. On the peak of the hill is an old arbor roofed with bark, and covered with the vine you call the American creeper. Its green is almost bloodied with red. The study is 30 yards below the old arbor, and 200 yards above the dwelling house. It is remote from all noises. Now isn't the whole thing pleasantly situated? In the picture of me in the study you glimpse
through the left-hand window
the little rock bluff that rises behind the pond, and the bases of the little trees on top of it. The small square window is over the fireplace. The chimney divides to make room for it. Without the stereoscope it looks like a framed picture. All the study windows have Venetian blinds. They long ago went out of fashion in America, but they have not been replaced with anything half as good yet. The study is built on top of a tumbled rock heap that has morning glories climbing about it, and a stone stairway leading down through and dividing it. There now, if you have not time to read all this, turn it over to Ock, and drag in the judge to help. Mrs. Clemens must put in a late picture of Susie, a picture which she maintains is good, but which I think is slander on the child. We revisit the Rutland Street home many a time in fancy, for we hold every individual in it in happy and grateful memory. Goodbye, your friend, SAML. 50. Clemens. P.S. I gave the P.O. department a blast in the papers about sending misdirected letters of mine back to the writers for reshipment, and got a blast in return, through a New York daily, from the New York postmaster. But I notice that misdirected letters find me now, without any unnecessary fooling around. The new house in Hartford was now ready to be occupied, and in a letter to Howells, written a little more than a fortnight after the foregoing, we find them located in art of it.
But what seems more interesting is that paragraph of the letter which speaks of close friendly relations still existing with the Warners, and that it refutes a report current at this time, that there was a break between Clemens and Warner over the rights in the Sellers play. There was, in fact, no such rupture. Warner, realizing that he had no hand in the character of Sellers, and no share in the work of dramatization, generously yielded all claim to any part of the returns. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Farmington Avenue, Hartford, September 20, 1876. My dear Howells, all right, my boy, send proof sheets here. I amend dialect stuff by talking and talking and talking it till it sounds right, and I had difficulty with this Negro talk, because a Negro sometimes, rarely, says oin and sometimes wine, and they make just such discrepancies in other words, and when you come to reproduce them on paper they look as if the variation resulted from the writer's carelessness. But I want to work at the proofs, and get the dialect as nearly right as possible. We are in part of the new house. Goodness knows when we'll get in the rest of it full of workmen yet. I worked a month at my play, and launched it in New York last Wednesday. I believe it will go. The newspapers have been complimentary. It is simply a setting for the one character, Colonel Sellers, as a play. I guess it will not bear a critical assault in force. The Warners are as charming as ever. They go shortly to the devil for a year, which is but a poetical way of saying they are going to afflict themselves with the unsurpassable bad word of travel for a spell. I believe they mean to go and see you first, so they mean to start from heaven to the other place, not from earth. How is that? I think that is no slouch of a compliment, kind of a dim religious light about it. I enjoy that sort of thing. Ears ever mark. Raymond, in a letter to the Sun, stated that not any line of the California dramatization had been used by Mark Twain, except that which was taken bodily from the Gilded Age. Clemens himself, in a statement that he wrote for the Hartford Post, but suppressed, probably at the request of his wife, gave a full history of the play's origin, a matter of slight interest today. Sellers on the stage proved a great success. The play had no special merit as a literary composition, but the character of Sellers delighted the public, and both author and actor were richly repaid for their entertainment. Ziff. Letters 1874. Mississippi Chapters. Visits to Boston. A joke on Aldrich, couldn't you send me some such story as that colored one for our January number, that is, within a month? Wrote Howells, at the end of September, and during the week following Mark Twain struggled hard to comply, but without result. When the month was nearly up he wrote. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, October 23, 1874. My dear Howells, I have delayed thus long, hoping I might do something for the January number, and Mrs. Clemens has diligently persecuted me day by day with urgings to go to work, and do that something, but it's no use, I find I can't. We are in such a state of weary and endless confusion, that my head won't go. So I give it up, ears ever, Mark. But 2 hours later, when he had returned from one of the long walks which he and Twitchell so frequently took together, he told a different story. Later, P. M.M. Home, 24th, 74. My dear Howells, I take back the remark that I can't write for the January number. For Twitchell and I have had a long walk in the woods, and I got to telling him about old Mississippi days of steamboating glory and grandeur as I saw them during 5 years from the pilot house. He said what a virgin subject to hurl into a magazine. I hadn't thought of that before. Would you like a series of papers to run through 3 months or 6 or 9? Or about 4 months, say. Ears ever, Mark. Howells himself had come from a family of pilots, and rejoiced in the idea. A few days later Mark Twain forwarded the first installment of the new series, Those Wonderful Chapters That Begin Now, with Chapter 4 in the Mississippi book.
Apparently he was not without doubt concerning the manuscript, and accompanied it with a brief line. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Dear Howells, cut it, scarify it, reject it, handle it with entire freedom. Yours ever, Mark. But Howells had no doubts as to the quality of the new find. He declared that the piece about the Mississippi was capital, that it almost made the water in their ice pitcher turn muddy as he read it. His sketch of the low-lived little town was so good that I could have wished that there was more of it. I want the sketches, if you can make them, every month. The low-lived little town was Hannibal, and the reader can turn to the vivid description of it in the chapter already mentioned. In the same letter, Howells refers to a letter from Limerick, which he declares he shall keep until he has shown it around, especially to Aldrich and Osgood. The letter from Limerick has to do with a special episode. Mention has just been made of Mark Twain's walk with Twitchell. Frequently their walks were extended tramps, and once in a daring moment one or the other of them proposed to walk to Boston. The time was November, and the bracing air made the proposition seem attractive. They were off one morning early, Twitchell carrying a little bag, and Clemens a basket of luncheon. A few days before, Clemens had written Redpath that the Rev. J. H. Twitchell and he expected to start at 8 o'clock Thursday morning, walk to Boston in 24 hours or more. We shall telegraph Young's Hotel for rooms Saturday night, in order to allow for a low average of pedestrianism. They did not get quite to Boston. In fact, they got only a little farther than the 28 miles they made the first day. Clemens could hardly walk next morning, but they managed to get to North Ashford, where they took a carriage for the nearest railway station. There they telegraphed to Redpath and Howells that they would be in Boston that evening. Howells, of course, had a good supper and good company awaiting them at his home, and the pedestrians spent two happy days visiting and recounting their adventures. It was one morning, at his hotel, that Mark Twain wrote the Limerick letter. It was addressed to Mrs. Clemens, but was really intended for Howells and Twitchell, and the others whom it mentions. It was an amusing fancy, rather than a letter, but it deserves place here. To Mrs. Clemens - intended for Howells, Aldrich, etc., Boston, November 16, 1935. 1874, Dear Livy, you observe I still call this beloved old place by the name it had when I was young. Limerick. It is enough to make a body sick. The gentleman in waiting stare to see me sit here telegraphing this letter to you, and no doubt they are smiling in their sleeves. But let them. The slow old fashions are good enough for me, thank God, and I will none other. When I see one of these modern fools sit absorbed, holding the end of a telegraph wire in his hand, and reflect that 1,000 miles away there is another fool hitched to the other end of it, it makes me frantic with rage. And then am I more implacably fixed and resolved than ever, to continue taking 20 minutes to telegraph you, what I communicate in 10 cents by the new way, if I would so debase myself. And when I see a whole silent solemn drawing room full of idiots sitting with their hands on each other's foreheads, communing, I tuck the white hairs from my head and curse till my asthma brings me the blessed relief of suffocation. In our old day such a gathering talked pure drivel and odd, mostly, but better that, 1,000 times, than these dreary conversational funerals that oppress our spirits in this mad generation. It is 60 years since I was here before. I walked hither, then, with my precious old friend. It seems incredible, now, that we did it in 2 days, but such is my recollection. I no longer mention that we walked back in a single day. It makes me so furious to see doubt in the face of the hearer. Men were men in those old times. Think of one of the puerile organisms in this effeminate age attempting such a feat. My airship was delayed by a collision with a fellow from China loaded with the usual cargo of jabbering, copper-colored missionaries, and so I was nearly an hour on my journey.
but by the goodness of God 13 of the missionaries were crippled and several killed, so I was content to lose the time. I love to lose time, anyway, because it brings soothing reminiscences of the creeping railroad days of old, now lost to us forever. Our game was neatly played, and successfully. None expected us, of course. You should have seen the guards at the Ducal Palace stare when I said, "Announce His Grace the Archbishop of Dublin and the R.T. Han, the Earl of Hertford." Arrived within, we were all eyes to see the Duke of Cambridge and his Duchess, wondering if we might remember their faces, and they ours. In a moment, they came tottering in, he, bent and withered and bald, she blooming with wholesome old age. He peered through his glasses a moment, then screeched in a reedy voice, "Colon, come to my arms. Away with titles, I'll know ye by no names, but Twain and Twitchell." Then fell he on our necks, and jammed his trumpet in his ear, the which we filled with shoutings to this effect: "God bless you, old owls, what is left of you." We talked late, that night, none of your silent idiot omunings for us of the olden time. We rolled a stream of ancient anecdotes over our tongues, and drank till the Lord Archbishop grew so mellow in the mellow past that Dublin ceased to be Dublin to him, and resumed its sweeter forgotten name of New York. In truth, he almost got back into his ancient religion too, good Jesuit, as he has always been since O'Mulligan the First established that faith in the Empire. And we canvassed everybody. Bailey Eldridge, Marquis of Ponkapog, came in, got nobly drunk, and told us all about how poor Osgood lost his earldom, and was hanged for conspiring against the second emperor, but he didn't mention how near he himself came to being hanged too, for engaging in the same enterprise. He was as chaffy as he was 60 years. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.